Hello, this is Joshua Mack and A Few Minutes with a Puritan. We're actually going to begin reading a new book today called The Practice of Piety, which was written by Lewis Bailey way back in the 1500s. It was a pretty influential book at the beginning of the Puritan movement. It was one of John Bunyan's favorites. And it helps us think about what it looks like to live a godly life and really how we can commune with God on a daily basis. So I think it's going to be super, super encouraging and super, super valuable. And it starts off with an introduction. He answers questions like, who is this for? What are we talking about? And why this book is important. And who is this book for? It is for people who want to be godly. And he begins with a warning, really. He says, whoever thou art, or I should say, whoever you are that looks into this book, never undertake to read it unless you first resolve to become from your heart a sincere practitioner of piety. So how's that for a start? Please don't read this book. Don't think about reading this book unless you are committed to pursue godliness with everything you've got, not just to impress other people, but because you really, really want to know God. And so as we start this book, we should ask ourselves, is there a firm resolve in our hearts to do whatever it takes to walk with God? He doesn't want us to even try to read this book unless that's true of us. But if that's true of us, he says, let's get started. We need to do it. Yet read it, and that speedily. Please read it and do it quick. Lest, before you've read it over, God, by some unexpected death, cut you off for your habit of ungodliness. So he is reminding us that ungodliness is something to take seriously, and that God intervenes in the course of people's lives to discipline them for their ungodliness, to even judge them, and that sometimes people die because they won't stop being ungodly. So it's like, wow. Wow, this is why I like to read some of these old books. They say things differently than we might say them. They come at things differently than we might come at them and remind us of biblical realities. This is a biblical way of talking for sure. So that's who this book is for. It's for people who want to be godly, and he's like, that should be all of you. Now, what are we talking about when we talk about the practice of piety? Piety is another word for godliness, really. But he explains. He says, first, in knowing the essence of God, and that in respect of the diverse manner of being in God, which are three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, the attributes thereof, which are neither not or either nominal or real, absolute as simpleness, infiniteness, relative as life, understanding, will, power, and majesty. Well, we should start there. He is unpacking what is involved in godliness, and where does he start? He starts with God. You can't walk with God without God. To be godly, you need to know God. G-O-D, in capital letters. That's how godliness begins. That's the essence of godliness. And so if we want to pursue becoming a godly person, we're going to have to pursue a deeper, deeper knowledge of God. And he wants to help us do that. I mean, this is it's quite a line. Godliness, the practice of piety, consists first in knowing the essence of God. That should stop us, like knowing the essence of God. Can we do that? How can we do that? And he says, well, let me just sort of talk about real quickly what it means to know the essence of God, or maybe more specifically, what I'm talking about when I talk about the essence of God. And he divides it into these two parts, knowing the Trinity, basically, and knowing God's nominal attributes, which are names or attributes given to God that help us understand him, but don't get at his essence, and his real attributes, which are descriptions of God's essence. Absolute attributes that, again, would pertain to who God is in and of himself, like simpleness, infiniteness. When you think about God, do you realize that he is a simple God? Do you understand what that means? That is a word we don't often use to describe God nowadays, but it was a word that was used by Christians in generations past, and not just sort of offhandedly, it was essential to their understanding of God, so we should know what that means. And then relative would be attributes of God that are related to the way that he works in creation. So Lord would be one of those, because you can't really be a Lord without a servant, without some sort of, so that's a relational kind of word. So I love this start. He wants to, this is like a devotional handbook is what the practice of piety is. And yet he says, if we're going to have any true kind of devotion to God, we need to think deeply about God. Just in that first paragraph, he probably used some words that we're not familiar with. And we don't use hard words just to use hard words, but we use words like this and need to know them because God is worthy of being known, and he is high and lifted up above us, and he's different than us. And so, of course, we're going to have to stretch our minds to be able to get a glimpse of God for who he is. So that's the first part of the practice of piety. The second, he says, is in knowing your own self in respect of your state of corruption and renovation. Third, in glorifying God aright, by your life, in dedicating yourself devoutly to serve him, both privately in your own person and publicly with your family every day and with the church when it gathers, and extraordinarily by fasting and by feasting. So godliness involves knowing how to honor God, and specifically with your life, just at home with God's people and in these unique ways like fasting and celebrating, and then by your death. So we need to know how to glorify God in how we live, and then we need to know how to glorify God in the way we die, in dying in the Lord and for the Lord. That's not, again, something that you find necessarily in a lot of devotional books nowadays. Let me talk to you about how to be godly. Okay, specifically, I'm going to talk with you about how to die well. Now, why is he taking this path? Why does he want to come at the practice of piety this way? He's going to explain. Unless that a man does truly know God, he neither can nor will worship him aright. For how can a man love him whom he knows not? And who will worship him whose help a man thinks he needs not? And how shall a man seek remedy by grace who never understood his misery by nature? Therefore, says the apostle, he that comes to God must believe that God is, and that he is a rewarder of them that seek him. And for as much as there can be no true piety without the knowledge of God, nor any good practice without the knowledge of a man's own self, we will therefore lay down the knowledge of God's majesty and man's misery as the first and chiefest grounds of the practice of piety. So how do I become more godly? I need to know this is the first step, the foundational step. I need to know God and His glory, and I need to know my own depravity. How do you like that? I need to know myself and I need to know God. These are really the chief characteristics of the kind of knowledge that produces godliness. Bailey is actually sort of riffing off of something John Calvin says here. Bailey was born in 1571. John Calvin died in 1564. And in Calvin's Institutes, maybe you've read them, he begins, "Our wisdom, insofar as it ought to be deemed true and solid wisdom, consists almost entirely of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves." If you want to be wise, it's essential. This is what you need to know. You need to know God and you need to know yourself. And if you think about our world, these are the two things that most people don't know. They don't know themselves. They don't know God. But as these are connected together by many ties, it's not easy to determine which of the two proceeds and gives birth to the other. So do you start with the knowledge of God? Do you start with the knowledge of self? Which is the chicken, which is the egg? For in the first place, no man can survey himself without, as a result, turning his thoughts towards the God in whom he lives and moves. So if you really look at yourself, it's going to cause you to look to God, because it's perfectly obvious that the endowments which we possess cannot possibly be from ourselves. Nay, that our very being is nothing else than subsistence in God alone. So you see yourself, you look at what you can do, who you are. We know this didn't come from us. It came from somewhere. There's a cause to human beings outside of themselves. In the second place, those blessings which unceasingly distill to us from heaven are like streams conducting us to the fountain. God's been so good to us, and He gives us all these gifts so that we might look to the giver. Here again, the infinitude of good which resides in God becomes more apparent from our poverty. In particular, the miserable ruin into which the revolt of the first man has plunged us compels us to turn our eyes upwards. Not only that while hungry and famishing, we may thence ask what we want, but being aroused by fear may learn humility. For as there exists in man something like a world of misery, and ever since we were stripped of the divine attire of our naked shame, discloses an immense series of disgraceful properties, every man, being stung by the consciousness of his own unhappiness, in this way necessarily obtains at least some knowledge of God. This is why Satan, he doesn't want you to know the glory of being a human, and he doesn't want you to know just the seriousness of sin. He wants you to live in the middle, right? Thinking you're an animal and thinking sin is not a big deal. And what true knowledge of yourself consists of is very different. It's knowing, wow, to be a human is so unique. I see that I'm made in this glorious way, and that should lead me to God. And yet, I've fallen so far, and sin has corrupted me so completely that I need to go to God, because He's the only one who can save me. So looking at ourselves should lead us to look to God. Thus, our feeling of ignorance, vanity, want, weakness, in short, depravity and corruption reminds us that in the Lord and none but He dwell the true light of wisdom, solid virtue, exuberant goodness. We are accordingly urged by our own evil things to consider the good things of God. And indeed, we cannot aspire to Him in earnest until we've begun to be displeased with ourselves. That's why seeing our sinfulness and our need is not so scary, because there is a solution to this problem outside of us, and seeing our need and our sinfulness should cause us to humble ourselves and go to God for that solution. Seeing yourself for who you are is only really scary if there's not a solution, or if you have to be the solution. Who, in fact, does not thus rest so long as he is unknown to himself? That is, so long as he's contented with his own endowments and unconscious or unmindful of his misery. Every person, therefore, on coming to the knowledge of himself, is not only urged to seek God, but is also led as by the hand to find him. So here he's saying, which knowledge comes first, knowledge of God or knowledge of self? Well, if I look at the knowledge of self, true knowledge of self is what motivates me to look to God. If I don't know myself, then I might think I'm fine, I might rest, I'm okay, because I'm looking at everybody else, I'm not looking at God. But when I look at myself, it should cause me to flee to God. But of course, on the other hand, he says, it's evident that man never attains true self-knowledge until he's previously contemplated the face of God and come down after such contemplation to look into himself. So you can't know yourself without first looking to God. For such is our innate pride, we always seem to ourselves just and upright and wise and holy until we're convinced by clear evidence of our injustice, vileness, folly, and impurity. Convinced, however, we are not if we look to ourselves only and not to the Lord also, he being the only standard by the application of which this conviction can be produced. For since we're all naturally prone to hypocrisy, any empty semblance of righteousness is quite enough to satisfy us instead of righteousness itself. And since nothing appears within us or around us that's not tainted with very great impurity, so long as we keep our mind within the confines of human pollution, anything which is in some small degree less defiled delights us as if it were most pure, just as an eye, to which nothing but black had been previously presented, deems an object of whitish or even of a brownish hue to be perfectly white. This happens to us spiritually, right? So long as we don't look beyond the earth, we're quite pleased with our own righteousness, wisdom, and virtue. We address ourselves in the most flattering terms and seem only less than demigods. But should we once begin to raise our thoughts to God and reflect what kind of being he is and how absolute the perfection of that righteousness and wisdom and virtue to which as a standard we are bound to be conformed, what formerly delighted us by its false show of righteousness will become polluted with the greatest iniquity. What strangely imposed upon us under the name of wisdom will disgust us by its extreme folly. And what presented the appearance of virtuous energy will be condemned as the most miserable impotence. So far are those qualities in us which seem most perfect from corresponding to that divine purity. Which is why Bailey, as he talks about what it means to be godly, is going to begin by helping us think about the essence of God, about who God is. So I hope you're excited as we begin this book, which is going to be very practical, because to live a life that honors God, we are going to have to work hard at knowing God. And it's a privilege to have men like Lewis Bailey, who went before us, who can be sort of like mountain guides, helping us climb higher and higher so we can see glorious views of who God is more and more clearly. And we'll begin trying to get a glimpse of that glory of God next time.